Welcome back to Copper Country Today. In this segment, I'll be talking with three people who have been at the center of some important issues in our area recently. First up, I'll be talking with Congressman Dan Benyshek about topics ranging from children of our veterans possibly suffering from ailments that were passed down to them by their parents who served in the armed forces. We'll also talk about the northern long-eared bat and the decision to list the animals as a threatened species, and also the effort to make sure the Sioux Locks stay operating at their highest level. Then Michigan Tech wildlife ecologist John Vucetich joins me as we discuss what to do next with the Isle Royale Wolf Moose Study. Lastly, Aaron Johnson, MDOT Transportation Service Center Manager, will join me to talk about road projects in the area that are part of their plan for the next few years. And I'm told that right now, Congressman Dan Benyshek is on the line with me. Congressman, are you there?
Rick, yeah, hey. Good to hear from you.
Yeah, nice for you to call in. Let me ask you, are you over in Washington, D.C. right now?
Yep, yeah, I'm at my desk. I was reading a memo.
Now, you're fortunate not to be here, not that it's ever a bad time to be in the Upper Peninsula, but we're getting about 3 to 5 inches of snow outside the window right now. So it's been...
Sorry about that.
It's been a return of winter for sure.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I wanted to talk to you about a couple of things that you've had come down the pipe recently. Let's start here. You're part of a bipartisan group to introduce the Toxic Exposure Research Act. Can you tell us what that legislation is and why it's important?
Well, you know, when I was been traveling around the district, Rick, I met a group of veterans in Sheboygan that made me aware of an issue that I guess I really hadn't been aware of, and that is that, you know, we're all familiar with Agent Orange, you know, from the Vietnam War, but there's also been toxic exposure in Afghanistan and Iraq from, like, burn pits. Where they'd burn waste and plastic and all that stuff, and the men and women were exposed to that sort of thing. So there's been some concern that even the offspring, you know, the children of people that have served and got sick from this toxic exposure, may have some genetic damage to their kids. So what this bill does simply is set up a research facility, okay, so within the VA, put together a national center for research into the situation where is there actually anything happening to these children or not, and to do research on that. And that's basically what it does is, you know, put together a research facility within the VA to, you know, see if there's any actual damage to these children. And I, you know, there's been so many reports, you know, from people right here in my district that there is a problem that, you know, we went ahead and worked on getting this bill going and getting the bipartisan support, both in the House and the Senate, to get it fast-tracked. So we're hoping that it's going to move.
Now, these are ailments that are being are suspected to be passed on from a veterans to their children and their grandchildren. I have to admit, I never heard of this before. Are we just scratching the surface and finding out about this?
Well, you know how it was with this Agent Orange thing. I mean, it was 20 years after Vietnam before we even started looking into the damage that was caused by Agent Orange. You know, I don't want that to happen again. I mean, our men and women have been, you know, working diligently in far corners of the earth, often exposed to, you know, different chemicals and in tough environments. And we should, you know, be doing ongoing research. Is there a problem going on now? We don't want to have people wait 20 years maybe to find out that there was a problem and we haven't recognized it. So this is a start to that process of, you know, making sure that if there's a something reported with a toxic exposure, that it gets looked into a little bit and you know, that there's a consistent pattern, or, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
That we actually take care of it and not wait 20 years after the incident before we start looking into it. And this is supported by the American Legion, the VFW, you know, Rolling Thunder, Vietnam Veterans of America. So there's a lot of people that are involved and that have been aware of these kind of cases. So it's worth looking into.
Now, during your time treating patients as a doctor, did you ever come across anything that might be explained by this?
Well, no, I never really did that. But, you know, I'm a surgeon. I never really saw children that much. You know what I mean? So it was mostly adults I was taking care of and, you know, surgical problems. So I never really saw this on my own. But, you know, I'm just going from reports of people that, you know, I've seen across the district.
Now, if we are able to establish a link between what our servicemen and women experience to what medical conditions their children or grandchildren may have, does that then make the government responsible to care for them the way we care for our veterans?
Well, I mean, that's the decision that's going to have to be made. You know, first of all, is there a link between, you know, what the veteran was exposed to and, you know, some disease entity that their child may have? So that's going to have to be done first. And it seems to me, if there is a link proven, then we'd have to come up with a, you know, a compensation plan for that. But that does not include it in this bill. This is first just to do the research, you know, involved to see if there is a linkage or not.
Yeah, we'll definitely keep an eye on that as it moves through Congress. Now, switching gears a little bit, the Northern Long-Eared Bat is now the most famous flying rodent in the Upper Peninsula.
Yeah, right. I know what you mean.
I really.
Well, you know, this U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, you know, they call it threatened, okay, mm-hmm. which is could result in some additional regulatory burden for people in the UP because they're going to issue some rules for behavior, you know, around bad habitat. So we want to be sure that everybody has an opportunity to comment on that to the Fish and Wildlife Service. You know, this is may affect people in the timber industry, the construction industry, anything where you're outside where bats could be living. You know, there could be some rules that you have to comply with. So they haven't come out with the rules yet. Actually, we were able to get the rulemaking process extended to allow for further comments. So I would encourage people out there, if they're concerned about, you know, they could be affected by some kind of rule, then I would be sure that they write a comment to the Fish and Wildlife Service. And you can find that by going to my website, beneshek.house.gov /bats. And we'll help you get through the comment process, or you can just call the office too. You know, we'll help you make a comment because we want to be sure that the rules that they come out with, you know, allow us to continue to do the jobs we need to do here in Northern Michigan. So, you know, we're a little bit concerned about what the rules are going to be, but the more comments, the better. So if you're possibly affected by this Fish and Wildlife rulemaking process, please comment. In timber, agriculture, energy, construction, transportation people are all going to be interested in this.
Now, from what I understand, now you don't have a position one way or another on whether or not the bat should be threatened or listed as a threatened species. You just want everybody to have their input before any decision is made.
All right. Well, you know, I'm a little bit concerned about what they're going to do. I mean, this long-eared bat, you know, let's face it, man, we like bats in the UP, right? I mean, they eat bugs. So, I mean, that's a good thing, and we want to see these bats, you know, survive, you know. But the problem with the bats is there's a disease. It's not really a habitat issue. It's more of a disease that's kind of running rampant in the bat world. And, you know, they don't have a cure for that. I think they should be spending money to try and get the disease under control. But, you know, like limiting habitat access to people, I'm not sure that's really the solution to the problem. The solution to the problem is a stop to this disease, but that's a whole other issue.
Now, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service did do a presentation locally here just recently because of a proposed wind farm, and they came out and talked about what that wind farm might do to the bat species. My question with that is just that if we're looking at stopping certain kinds of man-made activities like wind farms, then shouldn't we also look at some of the other things that we do, the logging and the mining, if they are affecting the bat species?
Well, you know, my biggest concern is, are these rules based on science? Okay, like the wind farm issue, you know, I just talked to a guy that has a wind farm, and, you know, he's, you know, being subject to all of a sudden by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife is after him because his wind farm is killing birds or something. Okay, well, so he studied the amount of birds killed on his wind farm, and it was like far below what the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service said. You know what I mean? They go around and basically count bird carcasses every day at the wind farm. You know, I mean, they have somebody walk it, and they did that for 3 years. And, you know, they didn't kill as many birds as they thought. So you have to be sure that whenever these guys are making rules that affect your ability to make a living, that is actually based on facts, not just, you know, some guy's idea what he wants to regulate. You understand what I'm saying, Rick? I mean, sometimes you've got to come up with rules that don't make any sense as far as what the real facts are. So keeping them grounded into the facts is, you know, what we're trying to be sure we do.
Okay. One last topic for you. You recently called for the details of a sensitivity analysis of the Sioux locks. This was conducted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. You're asking that to be publicly released. What is it that report expected to show?
Well, you know, when I was up there a couple of years ago with Carl Levin, he and I were wanted to get this replacement lock move forward in the Sioux. You know, there's only one lock in the Sioux that allows the big tankers to get through, or big lakers to get through. Well, if there's a problem with that lock, then, you know, it's going to be affect shipping and the nation's economy. I mean, like, I think like 5% of the nation's economy is dependent on that lock. You know, a lot of raw materials go through the iron ore to make steel and cars and appliances, all, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. All comes through there. So, we don't think that they, when they did their analysis, they gave the locks enough of a credit, you know what I mean, as far as its impact on the economy. I mean, you know, the Corps of Engineers bases its priority of getting things fixed based on, you know, the cost-benefit ratio, how much is it costing the economy. The other thing that the locks provide is it's a security issue, too. You know, if we can't make steel, that's a major security issue. As you may know, in the Second World War, they had 10,000 troops protecting the locks from sabotage. So there's a lot of things happening there, and I think we should have some couple of redundancies there at the locks, and you know, making sure that the economy stays strong in Michigan is important to me. And you know, we want the locks to be on their proper place on the priority list, and we think that it would go up in priority if they took into account the effects on the economy and stuff. So they did a study, which we paid for, so why shouldn't we see it? And that's the point.
Okay. Just lastly, now, the Sioux locks, so keeping them operational, it just seems a no-brainer that would be a priority. Why does anybody need to be convinced that it is?
Well, it's just the way the Corps of Engineers works. They have a priority list of projects that they need to do, and making sure that it's a high priority, you know, is what I'm there for. So we're trying to make that happen.
Congressman Dan Benishek, thank you so much for calling in.
Hey, Rick. Hey, appreciate being on, man. Thanks.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
All right. Bye.
That's Congressman Dan Benishek. Time to turn our attention to Isle Royale, where Michigan Tech researchers have worked with the National Park Service on a predator-prey study on the island that is now in its 57th year. But how much longer it will continue is now in question, since so few wolves are left. I sat down with Michigan Tech's Associate Professor of Wildlife Ecology, John Vucinich, and asked what was the purpose of the study.
Well, the purpose of the wolf-moose research on Isle Royale is to both document fluctuations in the populations of the wolves and moose, how it is that some years there's more and some years there are fewer moose, not only to document them, but also to explain why it is that sometimes the moose population is high and other times low, and same for the wolves.
Were there any wolves or moose on the island prior to being introduced for this study, or were they already native to the island?
Well, wolves got to Isle Royale almost certainly on their own in the late 1940s, and they did so by walking across on an ice bridge. Moose got to Isle Royale for the first time in historic times anyways, around the year 1900, and it's not entirely certain how they got there. It's very likely that they swam.
A study of wolves and moose has been going on for nearly six decades. So what has been learned about the relationship between predator and prey?
You know, the big lesson, the one overarching lesson that comes from watching a place for so long is how limited our capacity is for predicting what's going to happen next. That's one of the things that good natural resource management depends on. A good relationship with nature involves us understanding what the consequences of our actions will be. And in the work we do on Isle Royale shows that some humility and modesty is called for, because we're not always quite so good at those predictions.
The wolf population has been dwindling, but the moose population is exploding. What's happening?
For about the last 6 years or so, the wolf population has been declining from around 29 wolves to now there are just three. During the last 4 years, the moose population has been growing by gangbusters. There are now more than 1,200 moose on the island, or that's the number we estimate. They've been growing at about 22% per year for the last 4 years. To wrap your mind around that, imagine it was interest on your money in the bank. You'd be rich in a hurry. So that's what the wolf and moose populations have been doing. Wolves on the decline, moose on the increase. The reasons, well, the increase in the moose has everything to do with that there are so few wolves, and the decline in wolves has a great deal to do with the fact that they suffer from inbreeding. Inbreeding is what happens when there's matings between close relatives, and inbreeding among wolves on Isle Royal happens in part because the island is small, and so there never can be all that many wolves on the island just under normal circumstances. For many, many years that the wolves have been there, they've mitigated those inbreeding problems by wolves occasionally crossing an ice bridge from the mainland to the island. And when they cross that ice bridge, well, those wolves bring with them their genes, and they reproduce with the native wolves on Isle Royal, and that mitigates the inbreeding problems. What's been of concern is that in recent years, recent decades, ice bridges have become far less common because of climate warming. And so what's reasonably well understood at this point is that the inbreeding problems that Isle Royal wolves have are an indirect consequence of anthropogenic climate warming.
How come the moose aren't suffering the same inbreeding problem as the wolves?
Inbreeding is something that really affects populations in the shorter terms, like one or two or three, four generations. Only when population sizes get to, say, less than 50 or less than 20, that kind of number, moose on Isle Royal, on average, number in the many hundreds. And those numbers are such that inbreeding problems, they can arise, but they arise over, kind of hundreds of year time frames, much longer time frames than we'd be thinking about in this particular case.
You mentioned earlier climate warming. Many residents in the area will point out that our last couple of winters have been plenty cold enough to form the ice bridges. So how does climate warming come into play?
Oh, well, there's a difference between weather and climate. Weather is what happens in 1 year or 2 years. Climate is something that is a decade-long phenomenon or longer. And so to have two cold winters in a year, in a row, is not evidence that climate warming is not taking place. We know that climate warming is taking place. It's unquestionable, and that's all there is to it, really. And a couple of cold winters don't negate that.
Now that the wolf population has dwindled to perhaps the point of no return, what is the feeling going forward, and what is the future of the study?
Well, there are questions about what to do, if anything, about the very low numbers of wolves on Isle Royal. This is a decision that the National Park Service is obligated to make. And three options have been considered up until this point. One option is to conduct genetic rescue, which would involve bringing wolves to Isle Royal while there are still wolves there, so that an immigrant wolf, that their genes can be infused into the native population. That's the first option. Genetic rescue. The second option to consider would be reintroduction, which would be to wait and see what happens, and only if the wolf population actually went extinct, then go ahead and start the population over again by, again, bringing wolves to the island. The third option is to do nothing no matter what. If wolves go extinct, then so be it. It's a little complicated to kind of sort through what the best choice is there, but if you can start with the premise that the purpose of a park is to protect ecosystem health, if you take that for granted, then I think the solution is kind of straightforward, and that would be that maintaining ecosystem health in a place where there are large ungulates, like in this case moose, it requires the presence of predation. And predation has been severely impaired for the last 4 years, and what would be important for ecosystem health is to get that jump started as quickly as possible, really. And the best way to do that at this point would be to bring wolves to the island. It might be too late for genetic rescue. The wolves that are on the island now are so few in number. The two adult wolves on the island are probably a mated pair, don't understand that they have a problem, and aren't necessarily interested in mating with an immigrant wolf. So genetic rescue in that formal sense is probably an option that's already passed us up. But the main point is that bringing wolves to Isle Royal sooner rather than later is the most effective way to jumpstart predation, which means it's the most effective way to maintain and protect ecosystem health.
If it's decided that we are not going to interfere, that no new wolves are going to be introduced, what is going to happen on Isle Royale if we leave a runaway moose population with no predators?
Yeah, we know well enough that ecosystem health depends vitally on the presence of top predators wherever there are large ungulates. And we know that in so many places where large ungulates have been left to their own devices without predators, they ruin the forest. They cause great harm to the forest, harm that's not easily undone. It's been seen in many of our national parks, Yellowstone National Park, Rocky Mountain National Park, Smoky Mountains. It's a theme that's played over and over again in our national parks in cases where we've let predation go. And we'd expect the same thing to happen on Isle Royale. We'd expect it to happen in pretty short order, really. It won't take very many years.
So in the meantime, until a decision is made on what to do next, what is the next step as far as the study?
Well, the next step for myself and Rolf Peterson, my colleague, in all of this work is to number one, keep making the observations that we make to just know what actually happens next. And we'll keep doing that this summer and in the upcoming winter. The other thing that my colleague and I will do is just continuing with encouraging, you know, intelligent conversation about what's at stake and about what decisions might best be made.
So let's bring things back to the mainland. MDOT recently held a public meeting where they gave a presentation on their upcoming plans for roads throughout the area. MDOT Transportation Service Center Manager Aaron Johnson was kind enough to talk with me about these subjects. The first thing I asked was about how the work on the Portage Lake Lift Bridge has gone so far.
How did it go? Well, thanks to the people around here, really, it went very well. People were very flexible and understanding, and as we got the word out to get everyone prepared for these major events that we had, they went very smoothly, and that's a great credit to a really great bunch of guys that work for Zenith Tech, our contractor out of Wisconsin. They work through every conceivable weather condition and never stopped. But again, thank you to the whole community and all involved in the outreach to get the word out and everybody working together to rearrange schedules and get ready for those very significant closures, the all-night closures and the two-hour closures. We had many of those as well. Middle of the night. They went well. They went really flawlessly. We had a couple instances where emergency vehicles had to get across. There was no delays. We were able to get them across quickly. You couldn't have asked for anything better. You know, all the communication that we all did together to get the word out and get prepared, it paid off. These things went off, you might say, literally without a hitch.
The biggest project MDOT will be doing in the area is a complete reconstruction of Quincy Street in downtown Hancock in the summer of 2016. We've already heard the details of what is being done. What I wanted to know was why.
Well, the whole challenge on choosing road projects is the right fix at the right time in the right place. And when you look at the significant project we're going to do in Hancock, it's the right fix at this time. We've really gotten the life expectancy out of that road through downtown Houghton or Hancock. It's time to reconstruct from the bottom on up. It's only been maintained through the years, patched, some resurfacing occasionally. But those are short-term fixes to get the maximum life out of the overall pavement structure. We've gotten to that point, and it's time to reconstruct. It's very, very similar to what we did in downtown Houghton a few years back. Ultimately, the main difference you'll see is in Houghton, they had chosen to go for the brick paver. Hancock, it won't be that. But other than that, as far as safety improvements, very similar. We're going to have bump outs to narrow the pedestrian crossings at our intersections and create a more aesthetic appeal for our parking, and there will be new street lighting, some plantings, really an aesthetic improvement and a safety improvement in combination with a major reconstruction that fixes the road from the bottom on up and give it a good long life. But other locations where you have small projects, you know, you use the funding you have to prioritize what needs to get done first, so coming up in the near future, you know, for this year in this area of your viewership, there'll be a bridge job on M38 won't impact a lot of people. When you get there, you'll see a traffic signal. You might be delayed a minute or two, but that bridge needs, it's time to fix that. So that made the list now. But then we'll have a chip seal job south of Twin Lakes. That is the type of really more of a maintenance fix that gets you a series of shorter term number of years to extend the life of that pavement. But no need to reconstruct out there. So it's an economical job. It's a way to spend a small amount of money to preserve that pavement.
Copper Country Today will be right back.